Today at Reader's Corner, Kevin Grange, author of Grizzly Confidential, an astounding journey into the secret life of North America's most fearsome predator. I'm Bob Custrow. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Hey, stay tuned if you want to know if Brad Pitt really kissed a bear, because our guest today probably has the answer. He's a former paramedic and park ranger at Yellowstone and Grand Teton, where his work brought him face-to-face with North America's most fearsome predator, Ursus arctos, the grizzly bear. In his latest book, Grizzly Confidential, An Astounding Journey into the Secret Life of North America's Most Fearsome Predator, author Kevin Grange gives us a sneak peek into the secret life of a well-known species. His quest takes him from his home in the Tetons to an eerie, mist-shrouded island of gigantic Bruins, from the Bear Center at Washington State University, where scientists believe the secrets of hibernation might help treat diabetes, heart disease, and obesity in humans, to the dark underbelly of for-profit wildlife parks, one of which is in Idaho, illegal animal trade and black markets hawking bear bile. Kevin Grange is an award-winning writer with an emphasis on the medical field, adventure, and travel. His previous books include Wild Rescues and Lights and Sirens, The Education of a Paramedic. Kevin Grange, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much, Bob. I'm thrilled and excited to be here.
Well, Kevin, I really enjoyed your book. I'm a hiker. I've never come in contact with a grizzly, thank goodness. I may have seen one long distance when I've toured with family through Yellowstone, but it's a distant memory, if anything. Why don't we begin by you giving us some idea of just who this predator is, his physique, his speed, his hearing ability, his sense of smell. It's just an incredible animal we're talking about here. Have at it.
Sure. I think when you're talking about apex predators, whether it's grizzly bears or great white sharks or wolves, they are sort of at the apex biologically and intellectually in many respects. So with grizzly bears, which are the same species as brown bears, you know, they're really intelligent, as smart as an ape. They can run 35 miles an hour. You know, they have incredible strength, and they also have incredible physiology, you know, the physiology of hibernation. So they're just a really fascinating species. And the more you know about them, the more fascinating they become. And there's a whole hierarchy within the bear world. And so I started out not knowing a lot about grizzly bears when I started this journey. And by the end of it, I became, you know, an advocate for bears and their place in the ecosystem.
Now, you said they run at 35 miles an hour. I think I also read somewhere in your book that that doesn't last for long. They don't exactly have endurance going for them. I guess maybe that's something a hiker might want to know if he thinks he can outrun one. Just wear them out, although I don't think you're going to wear out a grizzly.
Right. They're actually, you know, we think of them as primarily carnivores, but they're more correctly described as opportunistic omnivores. Uh-huh. And when it comes to hunting, they're actually fairly inefficient hunters because they do have that burst of speed, like you mentioned, but they tire out quickly. So, uh-huh. You know, they'd rather feast on a carcass or maybe like an elk calf or something. But primarily they're actually vegetarians and just, you know, eating a lot of roots and that type of thing.
Now, you mentioned brown bears. Let's distinguish those from black bears. What's the difference here?
Yeah, I think for folks like you hike who are out fishing or hunting, color is not a good determiner because there are black grizzly bears and there's also brown black bears. So you really want to look at the shape of them. So the grizzly bears will have that prominent shoulder hump,
yeah,
which is actually a muscle used for digging.
Oh,
and then they'll have that concave face profile, that mm-hmm. dish-shaped head. And then, you know, they'll have longer claws and some of those type of features, whereas black bears won't have that shoulder hump and they're kind of face and nose is more pointed. So there's definitely differences. And based on which bear you encounter, you'll run or sort of react differently to which bear you're dealing with because they react differently.
So we're here in Boise. Tell us about the grizzly territory. I don't think this is grizzly territory, but if you travel east, it certainly is. And where else will we find grizzlies?
Historically, they existed, there was over 100,000 in North America, from the Arctic to the plains of the US, even down into Mexico. So that kind of speaks to their ecological flexibility. They can really survive anywhere. However, you know, in around the 1830s up through the 1960s, they were persecuted and hunted and poisoned. So now in the lower 48, they kind of exist on these ecosystem islands. So like the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem around Glacier. And as far as Idaho goes, they can be found, you know, in the Panhandle, in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, you know, in places like Island Park, and then occasionally in the Clearwater area.
So Bear 399 seems to be the favorite of anyone who studies grizzlies these days. Tell us about her. You call her at the closing of your book, the matriarch of the Tetons.
Yes, she was this fascinating bear that raised 18 cubs across 8 litters along the roadsides of Grand Teton National Park. And possibly she did this because she was kind of pushed there by more dominant bears. So she was pushed into this marginal habitat. But another possibility is she's this very smart, clever mama bear who knows that if she stays near humans, that will prevent the adult males from predating upon her offspring. And so it's kind of like the human shield effect. And so she's always by the roadsides in Grand Teton, and people just fell in love with her. And she's kind of what's considered a gateway bear. So they fall in love with grizzly bears through a bear like 399. And she teaches us all about, you know, their personalities or intelligence, but also like some of the threats and challenges that bears face. And 399 sort of died the way she lived. And unfortunately, she was hit and killed by a car in 2024. She was sort of my, you know, a lot of the book I owe to 399. And in 2021, she took a walkabout through the Jackson Hole area where I live. And she was appearing on all the trails where I hiked and even behind the grocery store where I shopped. And so I'd always loved grizzly bears. But then with 399 appearing on the trails where I recreated, I was sort of conflicted and very fearful. Sure. So I decided to embark on this journey to learn everything I could about grizzly bears, see if I could understand them, and then answer the question of how can we coexist with them.
Today, I'm speaking with Kevin Grange, author of Grizzly Confidential, part science, part travelogue. The book is both a gripping account of the famous North American species and a passionate plea for bear conservation. Well, since you mentioned hiking, why don't you give us the best advice these days on what a hiker does when he or she encounters a grizzly on the trail or off trail?
Yeah, I kind of look at it like driving a car. You can't eliminate the risk, but you can do a lot of things to mitigate it. So with vehicles, we wear seatbelts, we drive the speed limits. And so when you're in grizzly bear territory, which is expanding, so grizzly bear conservation is a modern success story. So they're really dispersing out beyond places like Yellowstone National Park and Glacier National Park. And they're kind of moving into these towns on the fringe and even the plains of Montana. So we should expect to encounter them in places that we might not have seen them in over hundreds of years. So typically the best practice is to hike in a group, to make noise while you hike, to carry bear spray, to avoid hiking at dawn or dusk when bears are most active. And those things work. You know, throughout researching this book, I had many encounters with bears and close encounters, but we were following the best practices of, you know, living and working and recreating in bear country, and all our encounters ended well. But if you take away one of those elements, maybe you're hiking alone and you're hiking at dawn, you're going to kind of amp up the risk a little bit. But those are the best practices, and they really do work, which, you know, is definitely a comfort to me.
So in one of those close encounters, is it wise to just stand your ground as opposed to running?
Definitely. Yeah, as we were talking about before, they can run very fast for these short bursts of time. So you want to stand your ground, because if you run, whether it's a mountain lion or a bear, you're sort of mimicking prey. So you can outrun them for one, and you also don't want to mimic prey. So stand your ground, make some noise, let the bear know that you're there. And, you know, 99% of the time, the bear will just see you and run away. Occasionally, if it's a surprise encounter with like a grizzly bear, then, you know, they might do a defensive charge at you, and hopefully it's a bluff charge. But if the bear keeps coming, that's when you'd want to deploy your bear spray.
Yeah, I don't know whether this really works, but I always carry a bell with me, the bear bell that you can buy at any outdoor store. And it makes some noise, and I suppose it's supposed to send a bear in the opposite direction. Do you think that works at all?
The bear bell could alert them that, you know, you're a human. A lot of times, if the bears are by a creek or a river, or else they're moving through the underbrush, they might not hear the bear bell. Mm-hmm. So what I like to do is I like to bring a little speaker and play some music. But a bear bell can work. And, you know, there's sort of a joke that
I know where you're going with this.
Yeah.
The dinner time.
Yeah. The bear bell is a dinner bell, but that's not the case, you know, because unless a bear previously associates humans with food, he's not going to really make that connection, you know?
Yeah.
However, for folks who are listening, who are hunters, definitely bears are really smart, as I mentioned, and they know when they hear a gunshot, there's probably going to be a gut pile. So any hunters who listen, you know, I'd advise, you know, once you shoot your elk or whatever it is, you know, definitely be on the lookout. And the most dangerous thing is if someone shoots an elk at night and then they come back the next morning to harvest it, expect there might be bears in the area and just prepare for it.
Well, for all of us who probably haven't seen a grizzly up close and personal, and for that matter, don't want to, we've certainly seen enough of them in the media, especially in movies. So I'm going to have you address the question I asked at the outset. Did Brad Pitt really kiss a bear? But more importantly, I thought you could explain for us how bears are as performers. This was a real eye-opener for me.
Yeah, definitely. In one of the chapters of my book, I traveled to Heber City, Utah, just outside of Park City, and I met with Doug and Lynn Seuss, who have trained famous bears like Bart the Bear for Hollywood films and documentaries. And their bears have acted alongside of Anthony Hopkins, Morgan Freeman, Robert Redford. And yes, their bear, Bart the Bear, did in fact give Brad Pitt a kiss. Doug and Lynn, I met with them to really learn about the brown bear brain and the personality. And in specific, these big, charismatic, goofy personalities that bears have when they're not food stressed. So along with that, along with, you know, training the bears, Doug and Lynn founded the Vital Ground Foundation, which aims to kind of connect habitats, you know, such as Glacier National Park with Yellowstone. And Lynn has a saying that I love is, where the grizzlies can walk, the earth is healthy and whole. And so where grizzlies appear, that's an intact ecosystem. So they are sort of indicators of ecosystem health. So if you have bears, you have wilderness, which is a beautiful thing.
I got a kick out of the fact that you mentioned that Anthony Hopkins seemed to be the actor that really, really got along with bears. He was their favorite. Is that right?
Yeah, he called Bart the Bear the finest actor he ever worked with. And in the movie The Edge, which is, I think it came out in the, you know, around 1987 or so, they offered Anthony Hopkins the opportunity to have a stunt double in a scene with Bart the Bear. And Anthony Hopkins said, you know, I'll do it myself because I really like the bear and the bear really likes me.
Unbelievable.
So one of the joys of researching this book was going to places like Katmai National Park, where they have the Fat Bear Week contest, and places like Kodiak Island. So you see the bears who are so well fed that their funny personalities come out. And, you know, sometimes I'd see a bear like playing catch with a salmon carcass with himself, or just almost like doing the backstroke, just, you know, sides of grizzly bears we don't really see here in the lower 48, because oftentimes they're food stressed and they're kind of displaced. But
sure,
up there in Alaska, you get to see a lot of really interesting behavior.
If we have time, I want to get back to Fat Bear Week and Kodiak Island, but I want to make sure we have room for you to talk about what happens when people attempt to create wildlife parks, if that's what you want to call them. They don't always work. Here in Idaho, there's one that is hardly a good home for bears. Tell us about the Yellowstone Bear World and how Idaho Governor Brad Little and the legislature protected it from oversight to protect bears from abuse.
Sure. Well, the goal of Yellowstone Bear World, and my goal in writing the book is to share the love of bears and to get people excited about them. And where we differ is Yellowstone Bear World, the whole emphasis there is on feeding the bears. And as we know in the wild, feeding bears or not securing your food or garbage is the number one way to make bears food conditioned and human habituated. And so, they say a fed bear is a dead bear. So I like Yellowstone Bear World's, intention, but I think the way they go about it and kind of promoting feeding of the bears, I think people will carry that behavior into the national parks when they go there, because the message is kind of to get that photo with the bear, you need to feed it, which is different than a place like the Grizzly and Wolf Discovery Center in West Yellowstone, where the whole emphasis of that facility is on not feeding the bears. And you can go observe a test where they kind of bait these coolers and garbage cans to see if they're bear proof, and they'll let the bears try to get in there for about an hour. So that's sort of the difference between, a for-profit park like Yellowstone Bear World and then a nonprofit like the Grizzly and Wolf Discovery Center. And some of the articles that came out on Yellowstone Bear World in the Idaho Statesman, some concerns about how they keep the animals and how they keep track of the animals and just how they were caring for them. And so, hopefully the folks there will respond to that, make the changes, because again, I do think their intentions are good. But with bears, the minute people think you can get close to them or you can feed them, that's kind of where the problems start to occur.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Kevin Grange, author of Grizzly Confidential, an astounding journey into the secret life of North America's most fearsome predator. So I don't quite understand the legislation that was passed and signed by the governor. Just what did it do that prevents the oversight? Oversight by whom?
As I recall, the Yellowstone Bear World wanted to be overseen similar to the way like an agricultural facility is overseen. And so with that, there's less oversight as far as, the number of bears you have and the breeding and feeding situation. And so I believe they were governed by both the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and then I'm forgetting the name right now, but the agricultural. And so they kind of removed the fish and wildlife oversight.
There are some really serious consequences for hunters, who you mentioned earlier, who shoot and kill grizzlies in Idaho, as you report in your book. Tell us about those consequences.
Yeah, well, black bears are typically poached for their bile, mainly in Southeast Asian countries. Whereas grizzly bears, they're more the victims of what we call vandal killings. And that's where people just don't like grizzlies on the landscape. So they kind of shoot them and just let them lay there. And so, unfortunately, in Island Park, that's happened a few times. And, there was even some articles thinking that there might be a serial bear killer on the loose, And that's unfortunate because I love Island Park and most of the people there love wildlife and, love coexisting with bears. But, a few people have done these vandal killings on grizzly bears. And so they just kind of, the idea is like shoot, shovel, and shut up, And the only good bear is a dead bear. And luckily, the Fish and Wildlife Service and Fish and Game, they're going after these folks. And in one case in Island Park, they used the pings from their cell phone to find out who was in the area on the day that this bear was shot. And it happened to be a sow with cubs. And so they're able to track down the two people that shot the bear. And so they are cracking down on that because grizzlies in the lower 48 are still covered under the Endangered Species Act.
And those guys had to do some jail time, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. And again, I think the unfortunate thing is they kind of give Island Park a bad name, whereas, most of the people there love wildlife and love kind of sharing space with them.
So tell us about Fat Bear Week. It's a national park, a preserve in Alaska, but I was really impressed with the artist Thomas Mangelson that you mentioned, who painted Catch of the Day. And I think many of our listeners will probably remember what you're about to describe in this famous painting. But the Brook Falls event is something that is just seems incredible, and you were fortunate enough to view it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it Brooks Falls, the scene of that famous Thomas Mangelson painting where the grizzly is about to snap its jaws on a salmon. Every late September, early October, they have this thing called Fat Bear Week, which is an NCAA style bracket where people get to vote on which bear gained the most weight, because gaining weight in the bear world is a sign of success. So that's what gets the bears through hibernation and that winter famine. And Brooks is unique in that they've installed webcams along the river, and millions of people have just fallen in love with the bears. And the bears get names and numbers there in Katmai. And that's pretty unique. Some places like Glacier National Park and Yellowstone, they don't really name or number the bears, whereas Katmai does. And by doing so, you can really make connections and see behaviors that you wouldn't otherwise make. So we've seen adult males hanging out with, young male bears, and we thought, hey, that never would happen. We've also seen sows adopt orphan cubs. And then there's other things you see, like one time a bear appeared in the camera and it had a wire snare around its neck. And so that's just, you really learn about the challenges that the bears face, and also some of the hierarchy in the bear world. There's sort of like a dance of dominance at Brooks Falls. The most dominant bears get the best fishing spots. So it's a real dynamic, fun thing to watch. And then once Fat Bear Week comes up, at the end of the year, millions of people vote and they crown the fattest bear. And it makes all the news, and it's really quite fun. And again, gaining weight is success in the bear world.
Another favorite spot of yours is the McNeil River State Game Sanctuary, where there's really a close encounter with bears, as you learned very personally. But let's talk about that sanctuary and the danger of mining waste polluting the salmon that are in that river, which of course would have a direct impact on the bears who eat them.
Yeah, McNeil is about 250 miles south of Anchorage on the Alaskan Peninsula. And the unique thing about there is the bears there have never been hunted. They've never been collared for research. They've never gotten access to human food. And they also have very abundant salmon runs and sedge meadows. So humans are basically like invisible to these bears. And because of that, the bears will just walk right up to you and walk right past you. So you can really get these close encounters. And while you're at McNeil, you travel as a group and you travel the same trails every day, and then you bear view from the same two spots. So the bears have come to expect that predictability out of us. And again, they have no fear or desires from humans. So, you can really have these magical bear viewing experiences. And so this place is unique in the world. And as you mentioned, there are challenges that there's a proposal to build an open pit mine in the Bristol Bay watershed, which is one of the most productive salmon fisheries in the world. And so, that would displace bears geographically, just because you have to kind of put in pipelines, and then there's a potential for it to pollute Bristol Bay, which again is this world-renowned watershed and fishery. So, even up in Alaska, which is a great swath of wilderness, bears and other animals just face these challenges.
Now, in 2022, I believe it was, the EPA banned the disposal of mining waste into Bristol Bay, ending the Pebble Mine project. But then the Supreme Court was asked by the state of Alaska to reverse the ban. I wondered, has that happened yet? And then the next question related to that would be, Trump is now president, and he's already turned on the oil and gas spigot and seems downright hostile to the EPA. It doesn't sound like a bright future for somebody trying to keep a mine project out of a natural resource.
As you mentioned, it was banned, and then it kind of a proposal was to reverse it. So right, the last I heard, it's sort of in the court system. And as far as the current administration, I'm not sure what their plans are for that project. I know initially, or most recently, it was a Canadian firm that wanted to build that open pit mine. But I just think in general, whether it's the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, here where I live, we have this intact ecosystem, but there's just millions and thousands of roads surrounding the ecosystem that prevents bears from moving to, say, Glacier. So I just think in general, the bears and all the animals that fall below them, there's a lot of challenges out there. And so, it can be depressing, but I also think with grizzly bears, and we look at they were on the verge of collapse in the late 70s, and through human effort, we've rebounded the population. So I think it is an optimistic story of conservation, and we can do great things when we want to and work together. So the challenges are out there, but I'm hopeful for the future.
So tell us what you learned at Washington State University when you visited the Bear Center.
Yeah, I'm a paramedic, as you mentioned. And so I have a great interest in health and physiology. And at the Washington State Bear Center, the bears there are all rescued or else they were born in the facility. But they're doing research because hibernation physiology, bears gain all this weight and they don't become diabetic. They can turn their insulin sensitivity on and off like a light switch. They also don't get heart disease. Even their muscles, they don't atrophy during their slumber. And NASA is really interested in that because the minute astronauts go up to space, their muscles start to atrophy. So at Washington State, they're studying all these things. And there's this great belief that brown bear physiology might help solve these human afflictions. And so they're kind of narrowing it down to exactly what proteins are involved and how they're doing it. But again, I find that very fascinating, and they're definitely making some progress.
So let's close on a lighter note. The teddy bear. For years, I thought that Theodore Roosevelt actually named the teddy bear after himself, but it's a little more complicated than that.
Yeah, Teddy Roosevelt, who was a great president for conservation, he was hunting black bears, and briefly, he had stepped away, and he wasn't having luck that day hunting black bears, and I guess his guide found a black bear and tied it to a tree, and his plan was when Teddy Roosevelt returned, he was going to let him shoot the bear. But when Teddy Roosevelt returned and saw the bear tied up against the tree, he declined just because he was a sportsman, but he is also a conservationist. And it wasn't a fair chase, which he believed in. So he didn't shoot the bear. But then I think it was the Washington Post put out a cartoon showing, Teddy Roosevelt and the bear. And then an entrepreneur in New York City had the idea to make a teddy bear. So it's named Teddy after Teddy Roosevelt. And it just took off. And I had one growing up. And most
haven't we all?
Yeah, it's quite the story.
Well, it's a great story. It's a great book you've written here, and one that I think is just so fascinating, especially for those of us who live in the West, and even more particularly for those of us who live in Idaho. Kevin Grange, I want to thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. The name of your book, of course, is Grizzly Confidential, An Astounding Journey into the Secret Life of North America's Most Fearsome Predator. Kevin, thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much, Bob. I had a wonderful time.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The audio engineer for today's show is James Baker, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.